We're joined in this podcast by a young fellow who's been really raising some very important questions about the present and the future, and the ultimate resource for human societies, including American society. That ultimate resource is population, is children, is ultimately the making of babies who grow up to take on the tasks and the achievements of the society itself. Jonathan Last is my guest. He is well known as a major writer at the Weekly Standard and many other publications, and now the author of a new book which quite directly raises the question. I love the title, but at the moment I'm searching for it, don't have it in front of me. So give it, if you would, Jonathan.
What to expect when no one's expecting.
Exactly. What to expect when no one's expecting. Well, I say this to a father of three, as I know you are.
Yes.
And I tell you that I'm an older man who is merely a father of one, though partly redeemed by the fact that I've got two grandchildren. But I represent even more than you do, though you're younger and I'm older, a trend which you analyze and which you rather bemoan in the new book. That is, people having fewer children.
Yes, I try not to bemoan it too much because I am not overly sentimental about children. I'm not sentimental at all in the least about children. And, you know, in a lot of ways, having kids is a raw deal. And so I sort of gleefully and happily acknowledge the reasons why people wouldn't have them. But as P.J. O'Rourke, you know, P.J. O'Rourke gave me this fantastic blurb for the book that was so good that the instant I saw it, I thought, why hadn't I thought of that myself to include it? He said that the only thing worse than having children is not having them. And I think that that's basically true. The problem is that someone has to do it. And, you know, you've done your part. I'm doing my part. And, you know, we'll all muddle through because of this.
Well, the best part is, in fact, the follow-on role of grandparent when you get much of the pleasure of the little babies as they come along and then the wonder as you watch them grow and become human beings, but little of the onerous maintenance costs and requirements.
You know, the funnily enough, the sociology bears that out exactly. They do a lot of work over the last 40 years on what's called measuring parental happiness levels.
Yeah.
And what they have found is that if you take two people who are identical in every particular marker, you know, the same income, same race, same religion, same geography, and you measure their happiness, but one is a parent and one is not a parent, the parent is likely to be 6 percentage points less happy than the non-parent, which is, I think, sort of undergirds what I was saying, that being a parent is kind of no fun. But on the other hand, as you get older, parents recover some of their lost happiness. So beginning at age 55, the parents become steadily happier. The people who did not have kids steadily become a little less happy. So the two converge again by the time they're around retirement age. And I think this speaks in a sort of pointy-headed intellectual way to exactly what you're saying, which is once your kids are gone and out of the house and not your headache anymore, and then you are facing down the possibility of grandkids, well, suddenly life is a lot rosier.
But for societies, there are statistical realities which are really, in many ways, worrisome, possibly frightening, surely exasperating. And let's go directly to the numbers, parodying or echoing Sergeant Friday. All we want is the facts, ma'am, just the facts. What are the facts about reproduction rates, generally the world over, and most particularly in the United States? You make clear that our overall reproduction number is 1.93. American women, on average, have 1.93 children, and that's below replacement rate, which is 2.1. Explain, please.
Yeah, so the only number I ever ask people to remember is the golden number of 2.1. And so when you talk about the measure of the total fertility rate, that is the average number of children that the average woman in a society will bear over the course of her lifetime. And in order for your society to maintain a stable population, you need a total fertility rate of 2.1. That's the replacement rate. If you are above that number for a prolonged period of time, your population grows. If you are below that number for a prolonged period of time, your population shrinks.
The 0.1 rather than the 2.0, the extra 0.1 is to take account of early death of children.
Early early death of future parents, right?
So and thus a future parents,
before they,
exactly.
Before they finish their reproductive window. And And also for infertility, too. So, you know, people who are sort of naturally sterile and can't have babies.
In the history of this country, we essentially have had rather low fertility rates, except that certainly in the last century, in the 20th century, except for what we called the baby boom. And that really filled some, I guess, about three decades, maybe four decades.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that if you go back to, we have our first census in 1800, and the fertility rate for whites in 1800 is about 7, and it declines steadily from there to here. If you look at the scattershot graph of this, the only major moment of increase is the baby boom. And during the baby boom, fertility rate just about doubles, and it stays doubled for about 22 years. And that's it. That's the only period in which there's ever increase. Otherwise, the line is, you know, the trajectory is steadily downward.
By the way, did you get a baby boom in other countries engaged in the great Second World War?
Yes, very interestingly.
So the war is a way of accounting for it. Why does war produce increased fertility and fecundity?
Well, it does, and this is what is so interesting. War often does not increased fertility. The Second World War did. The First World War, for instance, did not.
Uh-huh.
And so there's something very important going on right around 1945. And I talk about this a little bit in the book because the truth is this is a matter of great interest and great study and very much inconclusive study in the world of sociology. And what happens in that period following the Second World War is you have a whole bunch of factors lining up. You have, you know, people coming home and getting married suddenly earlier than they had previously. And so you have the average age of first marriage dropping, both in America and in other parts of the West following the Second World War. You have still, you know, no birth control pill. You still have sort of the old social structures about the order of marriage, then sex, then children, which sort of gets, you know, taken apart by the late 1960s. You have steadily increasing middle class wages. I should say not just steadily increasing, but like dramatically increasing middle class wages. And you have to have that again across the West in the post-war period. That seems to matter quite a lot.
Curiously, in the history of thought about population, in the history of demography, even before it was a specialty section of sociology, we had people, maybe you start with the Reverend Malthus, who are very preoccupied with overpopulation, with the inevitability that even, as Malthus put it, even though food supply increases only in arithmetic progression, population will increase geometrically. Two people will produce, four people will produce, eight, or is it 16? But very rapidly, you get so much population that people are going to push other people off the planet itself. The most recent major advocate of that kind of worry, of that kind of pessimistic concern, was a guy named Paul Ehrlich, sociologist or biologist, I'm not sure, but the father, surely, of overpopulation anxiety, all stated in a book that he did in the 1960s titled The Population Bomb. Apparently, Paul Ehrlich and even the Reverend Malthus were very wrong.
Yes, they were so totally wrong. Ehrlich kind of drives me crazy. You know, you shouldn't beat up on your elders, and Paul is quite old at this point. But his book was, what's so funny about it is that it wasn't just wrong, but it was exactly wrong at the moment where the opposite was happening. So he publishes his book, The Population Bomb, in 1968. And as that happens, two things are going on. First of all, fertility rates have begun to collapse in the West. And that fertility collapse just 12 years later will then spread to the developing world. The same thing, same fertility rate collapse happens in Asia. It happens in Africa. It happens in the Middle East and South America. But also the other thing which happens is the Green Revolution in agriculture, where all of a sudden food supply starts increasing geometrically, not arithmetically. And actually, this should not have surprised people. You know, Malthus was selling this, you know, this pie of food supply, which never increases, when actually, if you look at the work of economists Esther Bozrups and Julian Simon, what they suggest, and which most economists now agree with, is that what you get when you have increasing populations are you have increasing technological advance, increasing innovation, and because these things are cumulative, you wind up with increasing conservation. And so this is why today, you know, commodities prices have gone down about 1% a year for a century. And so commodities are now cheaper today in the year 2000 than they were in the year 1900 because of that, even though we have, you know, 2.5 times the number of people on the planet, it's because we have better conservation and better efficiency.
It is also worth remembering that Malthus, in a way, was engaged in theological analysis and really theological consolation. That is to say, as a clergyman, he was very aware of the basic problem of theodicy, that we are all constantly puzzled by how can you have a just and loving God when there's so much suffering on the part of the innocent, so much early death and disorder. To which his answer was, God in his wisdom has so arranged things that he thins out the human population. And if that were not the case, we would all suffer still greater catastrophe. The war and pestilence and famine and so on are all somehow disguised gifts to the maintenance of human society.
Yeah, and you know, as an addendum to that, there's a guy named Robert Zubrin who has written a great book about the whole Malthusian line of thought, running from Tommy off through Paul Ehrlich. His book is called Merchants of Despair, and what he points out is actually Malthus was also getting money from the British East India Company, and so to a certain degree, he was apologizing, creating a sort of line of apologetics for the practices of the British East India Company, which I would say today people on the left would not be particularly comfortable in sharing.
How interesting. I did not know that connection. A good friend of mine, and I'm sure you know him as well and appreciate his work, is Mark Stein. Stein, some 5 or 6 years ago, sounded a call of alarm concerning population decline in essentially Western Europe, where the replacement rate has dwindled more and more, so that in some of those countries, in Italy, for example, for native Italians, the rate is down to about 1.2 children per woman. And, of course, what he saw filling that void was a great influx, an in-migration of essentially Muslims, both Arab from the Middle East and the North African littoral and from beyond. But basically, the coming of an Islamic presence in Europe, which was bound to dominate, so that, he titles his book, America Alone. He predicts that by the middle of the century, or maybe much sooner, that is the century we're now in, by that time, essentially, Europe will have been Islamicized on a demographic basis. In a later book that he did, he seems to suggest that ultimately that fate might even affect the United States. What do you make of that kind of demographic anxiety?
I wouldn't say it's unfounded. It's, you know, it's certainly there. I don't know Mark Stein at all. I've only admired him from afar for years, and he's fantastic and brilliant. And I mention him several times in the course of my book because his stuff is so good. I would say this, though. One of the things which he doesn't talk about, but which they see, and it's really demonstrably true in the demographic world, is that the rate of fertility decline in the Muslim world is actually steeper than it is in the rest of the world at large. So all of the stuff that we're talking about, all, you know, in terms of the phenomenon of fertility decline, has hit the Muslim world even harder than it has us.
So what are
now, it hit them later.
What are the
so
numbers?
They will be sort of last men standing in all this.
What are the numbers
in Iran,
on that?
For instance, the fertility rate is 1.7. It's lower than it is in the United States.
I see. And in the Arab Middle East, similarly? Egypt,
yeah, in the Arab Middle East, when you look at the rates of decline, while their overall fertility rates in many cases are still higher, if you look at the slope of that curve, the slope is steeper. Now, there's then a question of, you know, well, what about Arab populations within Western countries, which is a lot of what Stein is talking about.
Yeah.
And there, we're also seeing declines. They are steep. But it really is a question of, you know, so how quickly are these people going to be assimilated into the sort of Western Borg state of, you know, the people who just have decided to stop having children? I think all of that is not to say that his fears should be discounted, because the truth is, if I lived in Europe, I think it really does look like, you know, as Europe shrinks, and Europe is going to shrink dramatically over the next 70 years or so, 75 years, they are going to necessarily become more Islamicized as they do that.
And what comparable prediction does one make on the other side of the ocean, that is, in the United States, or add for that matter in Canada and Mexico? Because surely in the United States you also predict a shrinkage of the, what shall we call it, the non-Hispanic Caucasian population. But
I'm sorry, please continue.
Well, but will you be getting a comparable and and balancing rise in the Hispanic population, which is what many people predict and worry about.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is, again, it's the same phenomenon with Hispanics, which is that the rate of decline is much, much steeper.
Yeah.
So if you look at, you know, Hispanic Americans right now, their fertility rates have gone down. I think the number is 27% over the course of the last 5 years, whereas the generic American fertility rate decline is about 9%. So their rate of decline is like three times the national average. And you see already in Central and South America, lots of those countries are below the replacement rate already. About a third of Central and South America is below replacement already. Mexico is just at 2.1, that golden number replacement, where 20 years ago they were right around 6.5 or 7. So in just a single generation, they've declined by 66-70%. I would say most demographers believe that within 5 or 6 years, Mexico's fertility rate will be lower than the United States's, which is an astonishing thing. I think we would never expect. But this is what's happening, and it's happening all over the world. And the question then really for us is, that 1.93 that we're sitting on, how sustainable is that? Because we are so dependent on the high fertility of recent Hispanic immigrants.
That 1.93 reflects Hispanic reproductivity.
Right. And without those, you sort of, if you run the numbers without the 38 or 36 million Hispanic immigrants over the last 35 years, mm-hmm. we are actually much closer to about a 1.6. We look much more like Germany.
You know, a curious side issue is that religion is supposed to have some influence in how we live our lives. Latin America is decreasing very quickly, you say, and it's a Catholic culture, basically, with Catholicism still taken rather seriously. Even more pertinent to this quick side issue of analysis is Italy, which is the seat of the Roman Catholic Church. And there the replacement, or there the reproductive rate runs around 1.2, I do believe, for the Italian native population as such.
Yeah, there's a joke in demography circles about how if you're in Europe, the fertility rate decreases with every mile closer you get to the Holy See.
There
so
you are.
if you're up in Sweden and the Scandinavian countries, it's reasonably high. And as you get further and further south, it gets lower and lower.
Well, so far, we've just been looking at the numbers and at the phenomenon. The time comes for some attempt at analysis. Let's take that very generalization you've just given. As you approach the Holy See, replacement levels get lower and lower and lower. How do we account for that?
It's difficult, and nobody has made a really good accounting for it, actually. Religion turns out to be an incredibly robust predictor of fertility, but what predicts it is your religious orthodoxy, which is, yeah, to say, how you practice it, not what it is you believe. And so what really drives fertility is church attendance. And so that becomes a fantastic predictor, not church identification. So in America, for instance, if you tell me that you are Jewish or Catholic or Protestant, that doesn't really matter. That doesn't really distinguish you fertility-wise from, you know, the generic American. However, when we start asking you questions about how often do you attend worship services, then you see really fantastic and robust correlations. So that people who never attend church or synagogue or whatever, never attend it, they have incredibly low fertility rates in America, about 1.4. If you show up just twice a year for high holy days, you're a little bit higher, you're about 1.6. If you go once a month, you're right at the replacement level. And if you show up at church once a week, and it does not matter if you are Mormon or Catholic or Jewish or Muslim or Protestant or Baptist, you show up once a week and your fertility rate is a very healthy 2.4.
This suggests, with regard to religion, and particularly with regard to Catholicism, that whatever its preachments and whatever its official numbers of adherents, nominalism is replacing religiosity. That is to say, people are nominally Catholic, many of them, rather than committed and seriously Catholic, and therefore the effect of Catholic doctrine upon essentially reproductive practice is vitiated.
Yeah, and you know what? What's further interesting, though, is I'm not even sure how much the reproductive doctrine is affecting it, precisely because you see the same things with Christian sects where reproductive doctrine is very different from Catholics.
Uh-huh.
And the Baptists don't have a thing about artificial contraception the way the Catholics do, and yet their numbers, once you drill down to the church attendance, the numbers of the Baptists and the Catholics are essentially the same. What I would suggest well, what I think is going on here is actually a shift in worldview between the people who are religiously orthodox and the people who are not. And, you know, what my sort of armchair philosophizing here, and this is not data-driven, most of my book is pretty data-driven, but this is just sort of my attempted analysis here between us. The curse of modernity, I think, is that it has shifted our perspective temporally so that we are focused very much on the present. And what if you think about what religion really does at the most basic level, like what deism is it is a demand that your temporal perspective is much broader. You must look at both the past and the present and the future and give each of these things a great deal of weight. And that's what it does. And that is what it is that gets people, I think, over the hump into having kids. If you look at life and you believe that you have both a duty to the past and a real anticipation about the future, then the present, which is, you know, all the unhappiness of changing dirty diapers and not getting any sleep and not having enough money to go on vacations to Paris and all those things that happen once you have kids, those sort of detrimental effects get a little bit mitigated because you're looking at a broader perspective. Does that make any sense?
It does make considerable sense, but it leaves still requiring explanation, requiring some hypotheses that give a sense of the ultimate processes in which we are somehow engulfed. This basic question, the population expansion that was predicted it went on for a while, but ultimately it began to decay, and we are essentially coming close to the point where human population worldwide is going to diminish and will diminish quite rapidly in some of the major nations. And the question of what has happened to alter all of our orientation towards reproducing in kind and building family and building strong national populations, what has happened to all of that to so slow it and reverse it? Your general explanation is given in a word, quote, modernity. But what really is, what really composes modernity in a way that affects population development, expansion, or reduction is where we need to go as we continue this conversation, which we will do directly after a brief pause for this. And we return to conversation with Jonathan Last, drawing from his strikingly interesting and in some ways quite worrisome new book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. That is, by the way, published by Encounter Books. But you do essentially assert, don't you, that demographic disaster is essentially worldwide.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that 97% of the world's population right now lives in a country where the fertility rate is declining.
Yeah.
And so there are only a few, you know, a few countries that have held out against this. You know,
where is that? Bangladesh or someplace like that?
Bangladesh has, actually. Good guess. Afghanistan has. There are one or two small countries in sub-Saharan Africa and then the Palestinian territories, and that's about the list. So really, it is a worldwide phenomenon spanning all continents, all cultures, all
religions.
So it
sounds like population expansion is somehow a side product, or at least is correlate with misery and a national disaster.
Something like that. Yeah. You know, Afghanistan is particularly interesting because, you know, again, we talked about war. War often causes people to have fewer babies. And the fact, I mean, Afghanistan has been in basically perpetual war for at least 40 years. And yet their fertility rate has remained incredibly robust throughout.
Well, let's return to the American scene and some of the factors that you track in the book as having affected a decrease in American population or the coming decrease. Still greater in American population. What are the 17 basic factors?
Well, you know, so the some of the basic factors are exactly what you would think, right? They are things like the decline in the infant mortality rate. That's a very good thing. Increasing urbanization, sort of demographically speaking, and this has been true for hundreds of years, the more densely people live, the lower their fertility rates versus, you know, people who live in more spread out rural areas. And so as we become more urban, we have had fewer people having children. But, you know, one of the big factors that's gone on is the real degrading of the institution of marriage.
Uh-huh.
And so as people get married later, as they do other things instead of marrying, like cohabitating, as marriages are sort of torn up by divorce, if you look at the state of marriage today versus the state of marriage in 1965, right before our fertility rate really collapsed here, it's very, very different. People get married much, much later. They wind up marrying at lower rates. They get divorced at much higher rates. And this has, I mean, there are a whole host of sociological outcomes about this which are just bad.
Would you add another factor leading to the degrading of marriage? Some friends of mine who are religionists and at the same time sociologists do argue this simple point, namely the further legitimation of homosexuality and then most recently of gay marriage tends to diminish and degrade the significance of conventional marriage and thus of conventional child rearing.
You know, I don't know about that. I looked at this stuff a little bit. I didn't look at gay marriage at all. I looked at homosexuality a little bit because it just seems logically true. I sort of mentioned this as an aside in the book, that if 100 years ago there were a bunch of people who were homosexuals, but because of, you know, social mores, they did not come out of the closet. They lived unhappily lives where they made do and had kids. Well, today those people don't have to do that. They can live life the way they would like to, and they aren't going to have children. So you would assume that this has had some tiny negative effect on the fertility rate, because just fewer babies being born, but so little as to be infinitesimal, and I think probably immeasurable with any sort of rigorous econometric analysis.
Well, what you just said assumes that homosexuality is inherent and sort of given constitutionally, that is, the human constitution. Again, the source of people I was just quoting would argue, no, that's not necessarily the case. Much recruitment goes on, and the evolution of homosexual culture involves persuading people or helping them to persuade themselves that they're homosexual and thus stepping out of the marriage race, stepping out of the reproductive race. Do you think there might be anything to that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, you're right that what I did, what I said does assume. It assumes that there is some sort of biological constant at like 2.5% of population, 2% of population, whatever the number. I would say I make that assumption out of pure ignorance. I have spent almost no time studying as a sociological matter, you know, homosexuality. And so I could well be totally wrong about this.
What about, here's another factor, and you do treat this one in fuller detail. Let's use the propagandistic phrase used to describe the movement, namely women's liberation.
Yeah, women's liberation is really something, you know, because what are women liberated to do? As a friend of mine, Ben Domenech, likes to quip, he says, there was a war on women, but it was waged by women and women lost.
What does he mean?
And this is, so what the 60s and the women's lib, which of course really took place in the 70s, what that really was all about was in liberating women of a certain social class, namely the upper social classes, to act and behave as badly and irresponsibly as men. And because these were upper class women, they could afford to do this because they wouldn't, you know, they had a support network underneath them to sort of help them when outcomes went bad. And as those mores have sort of spread down the socioeconomic ladder, they get to people who are sort of in more and more vulnerable economic and social positions. And I would say something like that has happened in America. I mean, certainly if you look at divorce and cohabitation, those are things which you see primarily at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And if you look at the very elites in American society, they get married late, but they get married at very high rates and they stay married. And so there is a lot of, you know, do as I say, not as I do behind the women's, you know, what has become of modern liberalism, I would say, and feminism in that way. You know, but what's really interesting in all of this is demographers measure what is called ideal fertility, and that is the number of kids that people tell you they want in a perfect world. And for 40 years now, our ideal fertility number in America has been constant. And so for all the talk about how over the last two generations people have rejected the old bourgeois paternalistic model, how people don't really want marriage anymore, they don't want kids anymore, the data says the opposite. You know, 9 out of 10 Americans still get married, even though half of them get divorced. That suggests to me that they still want to get married. And they say they want about 2.5 kids. Now, they're not having them. But I would say that the fact that they're not having them seems to be more about them not being able to achieve their fertility intentions than it is them having defined down what they really think about family life.
There are other nations about which we worry, we used to worry a great deal, that they were economically stirred to great achievement, that their populations were expanding in a way that would only fully fortify the strength of those nations economically as well as militarily. And thus they pose ultimate threats to us. One such nation was Japan a long time ago. I remember a colleague at Yale when I was still there who wrote a book about Japan is number one. Or
yes.
Yes. There was Japan. There is, of course, there was the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation. And, of course, there is the looming giant of China, still calculated as essentially providing one-fourth of the world's population. Are all of these nations also affected by the diminution or the decline in essentially in breeding new members?
Very much so. Now, Japan is really the canary in the coal mine in all this.
They're over the cliff, you say.
They are, right. And they're the first ones over the cliff. So Japan is already losing people on an annual basis. Last year in Japan, they sold more adult diapers
than
diapers for
yes,
babies.
Yes.
And they're going to do that every year from here on out to the horizon. So here are the projections for Japan. Here are the numbers. If tomorrow Japan's fertility rate recovers to the replacement rate, which it isn't going to, but let's just pretend for the sake of argument it does, then over the next the rest of the century, they will only lose 28% of their population. Think about that for a moment. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, if Japan's fertility rate stays where it is today, they will lose roughly 66% of their population over the course of the next century. And I would say it is really difficult to envision what Japan will look like because it won't be anything like what we think
I
of
have
it
a vision.
Today.
I have a vision of Japan's future. It suddenly comes to me. There is a Caucasian minority population in Japan. They are the Ainu, sometimes known as the hairy Ainu. They were the original population before the people who composed the Japanese nation migrated from Asia. Maybe the ultimate day of the Ainu is approaching. They still live essentially a folk-based life. That is, they live a rural life with a good deal of traditional culture. I don't know what their reproduction rates might be, but I can see something like a science fiction scenario in which the Ainu repopulation of Japan fills the void of a 60% decline.
Yeah, they may be the only ones left, and they'll have to turn the lights out. It's really something. You mentioned the Soviet Union. Russia has had much the same thing. They're following, and this is sort of interesting because this ran counter to what people expected. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dismantlement of the Soviet Union, people expected that Russia's fertility rate, which was pretty low, it was about 1.8, they suspected that it would rise. Because, well, it makes sense, right? They're being liberated from communism and all this oppression. And instead, it stank like a stone. And so today, they're around 1.5, and they are also losing bodies. They were losing about 750,000 people a year.
Are there any particular factors of specific and special relevance in the Russian case?
There are, in fact, and you know, the most significant factor is simple alcoholism, which is sort of tremendous. Think about it, this is actually fascinating. So alcoholism is so rampant in Russian society, and all the causes of death that come with that, vehicle crashes, murders, violent deaths, those sorts of things.
Well,
cirrhosis and whatnot.
I believe the male longevity figure runs about 58 years on average.
Yes, and so it is lower than what it was in Russia in 1960. And if you look, if you just go to the UN's website, you can look at a list of countries ranked by life expectancy. And Russia, I believe, of course I can be wrong about this, but I believe right around where Russia sits, you see like Chad. And so it sits right around a whole bunch of like third world countries, you know, where everybody's dying of like, you know, terrible diseases and whatnot. So things are very, very bad in Russia. And Vladimir Putin has, you know, made this a major focus of his regime. You know, he's tried to get people to have kids there. He's made a big public push about it. If you go over to Russia, they have put these special park benches in all the public parks in Moscow, which are their very short benches, which are sort of dipped in the middle, so that as you sit on the benches, the two people slide close together towards the center of the bench. They're called love benches to encourage people to get close to one another.
That might be a solution. I don't think it'll work, though.
No, it doesn't. It has not worked yet.
There's no country in the so-called developed world in which we see a reversal of the general trend that your book analyzes.
There's only one, and it is the country of Georgia. And Georgia's Georgia is the exception in a way which proves the rule. Georgia also had the same thing. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Soviet Empire, their fertility rate cratered. And they underwent a civil war. Their fertility rate went even lower. They touched what is known in demography circles as the lowest low fertility. It was around 1.4. And they are a very, very small, and you may or may not know this, a very religiously devout country. Mm-hmm. And they are all the same sect. Everybody there belongs to the Georgian Orthodox Church. So the patriarch of the Georgian Orthodox Church, a fellow named Ilya II, he saw this and he realized this was a big problem for his country. And so he said, I will personally baptize any third-born child. And the very next year, the fertility rate increased by 20%. The next year, it increased by 20% after that. And they are right now just under two. So they are the only country to sort of come back from the dead on this. And that is because, to a large degree, Ilya II is holding these mass baptisms every month where he baptizes thousands of kids. And it is as if the Pope had said, you know, to the Italian people, I'm going to come and personally baptize every third-born kid. People really, really responded to it. And I would say the example of Georgia is instructive and also a little bit chastening because it is totally unreproducible. It is an example that nobody else can hearken to.
Is it desirable in the ultimate measure to reverse the trend and increase human reproduction, increase the birth rate the world over? Is it truly desirable, or might we be better off, whether in the United States or, for that matter, in India or, for that matter, in Luxembourg or wherever, to have reduced populations and thus more people sharing the same or the still expanding pie?
You know, the thing is that what
rather,
worries
less,
us about...
less people sharing the pie, even as the pie expands, which in a way would promise greater material fulfillment for those humans left over.
Yeah, and this is what people promise you when they're the modern day Ehrlichians, the Earth first people. This is what they always promise. But here's the thing: the problem is that you can't get from there to here in a smooth line. You can't take our population right now, 7 billion or so, and just lop a billion and a half off of it. Because what happens is when you are below the replacement rate, the age structure of the population changes. And that's actually the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that you wind up with an older and grayer population. And if you look at the population charts of this, you wind up with many more old people than young people. And that is what causes all these dislocations. It causes enormous economic turmoil. You wind up with shrinking capital pools. You wind up with demand shrinking for just about everything except for healthcare. There really aren't any cases of countries experiencing anything but like economic calamity to stagnation with very old populations.
This will generate in 100 different forms the Social Security dilemma as well. You don't have enough earners to keep the coffers of a Social Security system filled and thus to sustain an ever-expanding aged population.
Right, that's exactly right. And that then becomes a developed world problem. So that is a problem we have in America and Europe and in Japan to a certain degree. But what about China? What about Russia? They're going to have the same age population problems, but they do not have these entitlement projects. So, you know, what will they do? Does it cause, in an autocratic country like China, does it cause massive political instability?
If one were a member of the Chinese Communist Party Politburo, would one now at last argue, let's stop the one child per family rule and let's start breeding out there again?
You know, it's funny. In the demographic circles, Chinese demographers have been urging for about 15 years now, like really begging the Politburo to rescind one child. And the people in Politburo keep resisting. And what they say is, don't worry, when the time is right, we'll just throw this thing into reverse and we'll tell people to have three kids and everything will work out. The problem with that is that there's lots of moments in recorded history where governments, autocratic governments, have decided they're going to convince their people to have more children by fiat, and it has never worked. So if the Chinese get this right, they will be the first ones ever.
Meanwhile, they will have created a modernized population that doesn't want a surplus of children around.
Right.
Well, we spoke of Russia, the founding father of the Russian communist state. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin did a famous pamphlet titled What is to be Done? It's a universally useful title. and I invoke it now, as I have many times before. What do you advocate? What should be done?
Well, and this is where my book is really a colossal failure. When you have public policy like books like this, the last chapter is always, it's practically in your contract with the publisher. The last chapter is always, tell us how to fix it. And in my last chapter, I sort of throw my hands in the air and I say, well, people have tried fixing this for a couple thousand years. Here are all the things they've done that haven't worked. There's a lot of good social science explaining why it doesn't work, and I'm not sure what we could do. I would say, now, this isn't to say that I think we should be paralyzed. I do think we should be looking to try to find solutions, as they certainly are in Europe, as they are in Asia. If you look around the rest of the world, this really is topic A. There's quite a lot of agreement between the left and the right, and there's a lot of policy work on this. But what I suggest is that in America, because our problem isn't that we need to beat people over the head and convince them that they should want children, because we already want them, what we should be doing is trying to help them bridge that gap between their ideals and where they are now. And that really is about not having specifically pronatalist policies, but sort of looking at bank shots. And so I say, let's look at like the broad underlying causes. Look at what Social Security and Medicare taxes do to fertility. And there's some good research on that, which suggests that it depresses fertility rates by about half a child. I say, so maybe we need to restructure that. Maybe we need to look at Social Security and Medicare. Look at college. How does, A, the cost of college, but then, B, the timing of college, which really lops 4 or 5 years off of the family formation scale. How can that be changed a little bit to make it easier for people to start family formation earlier and to do so with less of a debt burden? I think highways, oddly enough, are probably an interesting avenue to explore. One of the reasons in the suburbs, we have greater fertility rates than we do in urban cores. That's because people want single family homes. Single family homes are easier to raise kids in, but they need to live near cities because that's where the high concentration of jobs are. So if you build more highways, you give people in the suburbs increasing land affordability while keeping constant access to jobs in the city cores. And so I think building more highways could actually be a pretty good pronatalist policy, even though on the face of it, you wouldn't think that building highways has anything to do with making
and
more
And
what's babies.
Your own prediction? If all of these measures were applied and fully introduced, what difference would it make in terms of our ultimate demographic data?
My own guess is none.
None.
I mean, what I really say is, look, we ought to experiment. We ought to experiment rigorously, and we ought to really mine the data on this.
Yeah.
But I'm reasonably hopeless myself.
So your real message is live with it. Things are changing.
Yeah, literally, the alternate title for the book was, let's get drunk and make bad decisions, because that's really all there is to it.
Maybe accidentally make additional babies.
Yes, exactly.
It's been a delight talking with you, even though these are momentous issues that we've been discussing and not necessarily reassuring analysis, but brilliant analysis that we've had from you. And the new book by Jonathan Last is titled What to Expect When No One's Expecting. Wonderful title. America's Coming Demographic Disaster, just published by Encounter Books. Jonathan, thank you so much. It's been a valuable conversation.
No, thank you.
And hope to talk to you again.
Summer.